Okay, other announcements about upcoming stuff anyone wants to share? Please. So, equanimity, Pali word is upekkha. One of the four Brahma Viharas, or divine abodes, okay, states or realms of consciousness that the Buddha recommended we cultivate. It's also one of the seven factors of enlightenment. The Buddha talked about this teaching about the Bodhyanga, the limbs of enlightenment. He spoke about, you know, as your practice matures and whatnot, there are certain qualities of mind and motives that become over time a little more ripe, a little more, a little stronger, and kind of begin to reinforce and support each other, you know. Mindfulness, sense of inquiry or interest, energy, rapture, calmness, and equanimity. That's the last one. Okay. Calmness, concentration, and equanimity. And the reason that that gets as much emphasis as it does in several of the Buddha's different lists and teaching systems and whatnot is because in some ways it is the great open field that within which all these other qualities of mind arise and change and pass away and arise again. It is the Buddha field. It is the great kind of seemingly boundless expanse. You know, what's called in the Mahayana, the mind that contains all things and yet is not made up of them. You know, and Suzuki Roshi once said, the way to train a cow is to give it a great huge field to wander around in. And so it's this space that allows all things to occur without reactivity. A Zen story about trying to demonstrate the quality of equanimity is the samurai comes to the zendo and demands of the Zen master who's sweeping the place out, the little, you know, country zendo. I would learn the Dharma, says the samurai. And the Zen master says, well, I hold Dharma classes on Saturday, come back then. You don't usually talk to a samurai that way. They tend to take it the wrong way, and this guy certainly did it. But the hand on the hilt of the sword starts to draw. It says, do you not know who I am? I am one who could run you through without blinking an eye. And the Zen master says, yes, and I am one who could be run through without blinking an eye. And of course, in the stories, Samurai bows, leaves, comes back on Saturday. So that ability to be with literally anything, you know, what Nicholas Kantzasakis and Zorba the Greek calls the whole catastrophe, all of it, every bit of it. So each of these Brahma Viharas or divine abodes has what's called its far enemy and its near enemy, you know, which is to say its polar opposite and something that's kind of like it except not really. So the polar opposite of the far enemy of equanimity is restlessness and worry, which is also one of the five hindrances, right? Fear, anxiety, you know, sense of unease, mental unease. The near enemy is usually referred to as something like deliberate indifference, which is to say this kind of stony, cold demeanor that appears to be untouched by anything. The Tibetan teacher Pema Chodron once, when she was holding giving a talk and taking questions, she was challenged by somebody who was quite active and, you know, engaged Buddhist activities at the time. And she was giving this talk on equanimity, and he says, you know, it seems to me like that this is really kind of a cop-out, that you want to cultivate this quality of mind so that you're untouched by the cares and the sufferings of the world, and you can just kind of blank everything out and create your own little bubble where nothing can touch you, nothing can harm you, and it seems like basically all you want to do is remove yourself from the world and bliss out and have that be the end of it. And she was fairly forthright in saying, well, you know, that's really kind of a misunderstanding of what equanimity is all about. In fact, she said that the cultivation of equanimity is, in fact, what makes it possible for you to open your heart to the suffering of the world and to begin to take some responsibility for it and to discern what the skillful means are of addressing it. Because she said, if you're not coming from a place of equanimity and you get engaged in these issues, they'll burn you up, you know, like a moth to a flame. You know, your own rage, your own despair, you know, it will preclude your ability to skillfully apply the insights of the Dharma to the situation at hand. There's this fairly famous story of the sort of the patriarch or the leader of Cambodian Buddhism. Again, Buddhism was the state religion in Cambodia at the time that the Khmer Rouge overran the place and began murdering. And they began to systematically murder all of the monastics in Cambodia, destroyed the temples, and they started killing off the priesthood and the nuns, you know, working their way down through the ranks, you know. So it was this massive slaughter of thousands upon thousands of monastics. And also, of course, the lay people who had been contributing to the temples and whatnot, you know, there were over 2 million people killed, I mean, during the kind of reign of terror of the Khmer Rouge. And as this began to take over the country, people were fleeing Cambodia with only what they had on their backs, you know, trying to get away from this terrible, murderous regime. And he set about putting together these refugee camps in the surrounding countries, you know, especially in Thailand, who were receiving these refugees. And he did this for years and years until finally the Khmer Rouge were defeated by the Vietnamese. In 1996, he was awarded a kind of an international peace prize for his work. And he was asked at the time, these people who were fleeing Cambodia, you know, these monks and nuns who had been mutilated or tortured, or the stories he was hearing about his dear friends who had all been, you know, assassinated by Khmer Rouge, he said, given the enormity of the suffering that was being inflicted upon your Sangha, how could you even find it in your heart to do the work you did without being consumed by hate, without being consumed by rage, without being consumed by despair? And his response was, you know, pretty much the entire time I was doing this work, I was making peace with myself. There's this book by Jack Kornfield called Path with Heart. It was written a bunch of years ago. And one of the chapters in the book is titled Stopping the War Within. And so what Mahaposananda was talking about was that there is this horrible war engulfing the entirety of Cambodian Buddhism and the entirety of Cambodian society. And he was doing what he could to heal from this, to help his people get over it. And he said, in order for me to be able to do that, I had to be continuously making peace with myself. That my own equanimity was the place of refuge, the sanctuary from which it was possible for me to sort of move forward and do the work I did. So in cultivating this quality of equanimity, you know, when we look at the Dharma wheel, at the depiction of the Eightfold Path, we have the three meditative qualities, you know, samadhi, the two wisdom qualities, panya, and then the three sila factors, you know, of skillful speech, action, and way of life. And the cultivation of equanimity, the meditative factors. What happens when the mind becomes really, really calm? Another one of the factors of enlightenment. And really deeply relaxed is that it becomes possible to relax the mind to the point where the discursive mind ceases to create the self. In other words, it ceases to construct an I. The Buddha called it I-making and me-making. He said, when the mind becomes calm enough, it becomes possible, at least temporarily, to cease the I-making and the me-making. And he said, when that time arrives, there are no longer objects in the world because there is no longer a subject to view them. In the verses on the faith mind, the third Zen elder, one of the founders of Zen thought, he writes, to live in the great way is neither easy nor difficult, but those with limited views are fearful and irresolute. The faster they hurry, the slower they go, and clinging and attachment cannot be limited. Even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. Right? So you say, and you know, and this is one of the things that we all find ourselves as one of the great cosmic jokes of the Dharma. You know, ego wants to be around for its own funeral. You know, it's what Jack Kornfield used to describe. You know, that essentially you need to find yourself in a place where you are no longer, where I am no longer keen on getting enlightenment. Right? So I no longer have the goal of being enlightened, of being in some way other than I am. You know, because all these people say all the time, if we can hear it, that this state of non-self, the enlightened state of mind, is already within us. It's already there. It's not something to be sought. It's not something to be pursued. It's something to kind of be relaxed into. Said, if you wish to move in the one way, do not dislike even the world of senses and ideas. Indeed, to accept them fully is identical with enlightenment. So, that's where the near enemy of equanimity comes in, trying to shut out the world. I won't be touched by any of the 10,000 joys or the 10,000 sorrows, you know, as the Chinese texts say. It's rather to open to it all and embrace it all, but to do so in a way that, that leaves out nothing, right? That is there for it all. And of course, as we all know, it's easier said than done. So the mind can become peaceful and open and unclouded to the point where sometimes you can get this little taste of the self getting kind of wavy, you know, kind of like in Star Trek when they beam me up, Scotty, you know, and the things that had looked solid and hard, all of a sudden, this kind of looked like little points of light, and things get a little soft. When they get to that point, the Buddha advises that there's a set of reflections that you can work with that actually help you to cultivate equanimity. To be, it's basically a way to kind of check your equanimity game, you know, how you're doing in this realm. And it's to remind yourself of these various aspects of existence that he would bring up from time to time in his talks. I am of a nature to age. I've not gotten beyond aging. Are you okay with that? It's the truth. It's how things are. Is that something that, yeah, of course. You know, I'm in this body, you know, this two mortal coil. All compounded things are impermanent. They chanted as the Buddha was dying, as he had, you know, asked them to do, just to remember that, you know. I'm just like you. I rose, I changed, and now I'm passing away. So, you know, I'm of a nature to age, I've not gotten beyond aging. I'm subject to illness and infirmity, not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. I'm of a nature to die, I've not gotten beyond death. So if you're still chilled out, then here comes the next one. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. So being open to understanding of accepting of the inevitability of loss. And so when each time you say one of these things, it's a way to say, whoops, not quite there yet. You know? And that's all right. This is just a way of checking in with yourself. You know, because to the extent that you can set aside all the time to go through these, gradually they become more comfortable and you find yourself able to accept them a little more completely. And that very acceptance cultivates equanimity in a pretty powerful way. The last of the five recollections is, I am born of my karma, I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. And basically that's based on this understanding of the cyclical and replicative nature of karma. That as we have spoken and acted and lived our lives in the past, whether or not you subscribe to, you know, rebirth, but whether how you lived your life in your past yesterday, or the day before, or 10 years ago, you know, or when you were serving in Vietnam, whenever it was, you know. Basically, we are in the inheritors of our past words and deeds, the way of life. You know, my actions are the womb from which I have sprung. My actions are my relations, because every act we take is interactive in nature. We're all involved in kind of this web, this network, and everything we do or say inevitably affects another. And another aspect of this one is, my actions are my protection. What do you think the Buddha meant when he said, my actions are my protection? The floor is open.
You have control over your actions. You can change them and have positive action.
Mm-hmm.
You can have positive karma.
Yep.
You have control over your actions, so you can do positive things. We have the ability to do that and then create positive karma. And that way the actions would be our protector.
Mm-hmm.
Which is easier said than done, too.
Please.
Would that also be the foundation of engaged Buddhism?
Sure, of course it is. Right. What's being said here is the same thing Pema Chodron was saying. You know, the same thing Mahakosananda was saying, is that when you are residing in a state of equanimity, of non-reactiveness, of non-duality, then any words, deeds, way of life that ensues from that state of mind can only inure to the good, can only inure to the wholesome, can only inure toward the cessation of suffering. And by that means, when you're not harming another, okay, then you are likewise not harming yourself. You're not creating the potential to be harmed by virtue of the actions that you've taken. It might be harmed for other reasons, but it won't be because of how you behaved in the world. So that's what's meant by that observation, you know, my actions are my protection. That is really, I think, kind of a central teaching for our times. If, when you find yourself feeling despair or rage or isolation or just a sense of deep disturbance, you know. Over the last few months, the ongoing cultivation of it, I'm just going to read this. I have some notes that I put together, but over the last few months, the ongoing cultivation of equanimity has begun to assume increasing importance in my own practice. When it is the refuge from which I venture forth, I tend to have more faith and confidence in what I do or say. When I forget the importance of this place and lose faith in this mind, is when I tend to feel the most hopeless, despairing, and fearful for our collective future. So, just in terms of my day-to-day happiness in the world, you know, it's so helpful for me, kind of like that image of the eye of the hurricane. You know, I know that I'm going to be going forth into this kind of maelstrom of activity. You know, that's why the Sen Sen Ming is usually translated as verses on the faith mind, or verses on the mind of absolute trust. It's the same, when you are able to come from this place of equanimity, then it is as if you have created this aura of beneficence in the world. This trust in your own mind, this trust in your ability to be in the world, to be with others, including being with people that you don't agree with, or in difficult situations, that as long as you're in touch with that place, you know, if you're coming from a place of genuine equanimity, you know, and compassion, as we've, you know, we're talking about last time, kindness, right, that this creates an aura, okay, of well-being, you know, in terms of our own state of mind, in terms of the people that we interact with. You know, I'm involved in some of the service activities I do are inevitably somewhat confrontational in nature. For instance, some environmental justice litigation activities I'm involved in and whatnot, and I'm sometimes just struck by the strength of the opposing states of mind of the people who are engaged in these, you know. And there's the inevitable potential to see unskillfulness, to see all the things that the Buddha advises to avoid, you know, in terms of aversion and greed and, you know, willful ignorance and whatnot. And there's this tendency for the mind to get very, very polarized. You know, I feel that kind of arise in me, you know. And when I feel those things is when I feel vulnerable, when I feel afraid, when I feel powerless, basically, because I know that to move forward from that state of mind, no good will come of it. I heard an interview, there was a story in New York a few years ago. It was about this program they had of starting up neighborhood bands and music groups in some of the toughest neighborhoods in New York City, some of the most gang-ridden neighborhoods that were out there. And there is this one student, this guy who was part of this program, who was a gangbanger, you know, and but he was really into his music. He was really learning this instrument, you know, he's learning to play the trumpet. And some, and he was asked, well, what makes you come here? How do you feel differently when you're in here than when you're on the street? And he said, when I'm on the street, holding my peace, I feel afraid. When I'm in here, when I'm holding my trumpet, I don't feel afraid. Don't feel fear when I'm holding my trumpet, you know. That was his version of equanimity, of having found a place of peace within his own heart, where he felt whole, where he felt safe, right? And that's pretty much what we're talking about here as well. Thank you. Please.
So you're talking about being in that place of opposition, right, in the courtroom, or in the legal battles.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the same as the political situation that's going on in the country, right?
Yes.
And so I hear that sense of vulnerability, of feeling like, and it's brought on by typically the responses of other folks.
Yes.
And so you're feeling, you're in this place of wanting, all of a sudden feeling like you have to defend yourself.
Yes.
And in that moment, I'm wondering what you do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you come to equanimity? Do you take a breath? Do you
mm-hmm.
go and say, I gotta go meditate, see ya?
Good question, thank you very much. Personally, I try to make sure that one of the first things I do every morning is sit. Because otherwise, if I get up and turn on the computer and start reading emails, then I'm off to the races. You know? But if, whether it's for a long period or a short period, if I can at least spend some time in that space at the beginning of the day, then when I go forth, I'm aware of how close my mind is to still being in that space versus being elsewhere. It's kind of like a touchstone, you know, like if you start off on a hike or something, you want to make sure you have a pretty good idea of where you are before you start out. It's a reference point in terms of where you want to go. There is a woman who for quite a few years was part of this Sangha, who is a criminal defense attorney. And we were having discussion about the Brahma Viharas and about the practice of metta. She was, and we talked about this on retreat. And she was saying how beneficial she had found the practice of the Brahma Viharas to be. Because she said what she found herself beginning to do from time to time, she was kind of like the gangbanger on the street whenever she'd go into a courtroom. She said, I always felt afraid or anxious, you know, because she is oftentimes representing somebody been accused of doing something pretty unwholesome. And she said, eventually what I began to experiment with doing was as I would enter the courtroom, I would start send metta to the judge. Send metta to the jurors, send metta to my client. And she said, depending on who it was, every once in a while I could even wind up sending some to the prosecutor. But she said when, after she'd been doing it for a while and realized the effect it was having, the fear dissipated. And she didn't, it wasn't that it wasn't always there, you know, and there's some anxiety or whatever, but she said she really felt that as she moved into the courtroom, it was no longer such a hostile place. It was a place of engagement. It was a place of contention, you know, of contested facts and contested points of law. But it no longer felt like sort of the hostile battleground that one's had. And so there was something about her own state of mind that her and that changed her experience of the environment she found herself in. And little bit by little bit, sometimes I'm finding that to be possible for myself as well. And that's one of the reasons I commend this practice, you know, whether in terms of both its personal level and also the effect it has on others when we're coming from that place. We've also now come to the place of 8 p.m. So before we go our separate ways, if we could just for one moment return to our sitting posture. Allowing the eyes to gently close. Attention to come to rest once again on our breathing. May we live with ease. Safe from all inner and outer harm. May we rest in silence and stillness and spaciousness. At peace with things as they are. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free. And as we go our separate ways, this evening, there is one last text that I would like to share with you, if I could. It's by Jalaluddin Rumi. It's called The Guest House. This human being is a guest house, every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them all at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond.